for robot building supplies. Supply and deliver all the products you need to get the job done right.
Afternoons with Andy Marr on SEN.
Well, let's hope that as I welcome you back to the show, that as I say, good afternoon to you, Terry Wallace. There is actually Terry Wallace on the other end of the microphone. Plough, please tell me you're there.
Good afternoon, Andy. Hope you're well. how are things down in Hobart? Because we got a pretty big game on tonight.
We have, mate. She's a bit cloudy down here. There's no showers at this stage, but they look like they could roll around at any stage. There has been a bit of a bath thrown down here, I must say. And I don't know whether Eddie McGuire's going to be in town down here, of course, the president slash chairman of the Melbourne Stars, but the local newspaper down here, Terry, the Mercury, on its news agency banner out the front has got a big photo of Eddie McGuire triumphantly punching the air with a satisfied look on his face, surrounded by the headline, Eddie's Underachievers, Flop Stars, Tough Task. So Melbourne Stars, of course, have had a blighted history in the BBL, and the locals down here have certainly put her in front of the high-profile chairman of the Stars organisation.
Well, the one thing I'll say about that is that, like in any sport, if you keep getting there, you keep presenting yourself with the chance and the opportunity, and that's all you can do in this world. And, you know, hopefully from a Stars point of view that they can actually turn that around. But, gee, you have to say the Hurricanes have been the premier side for the whole tournament so far, and you've been very, very close at hand with it all. But, yeah, they've been the Stars, and it's up to the Stars to be able to turn that around.
Yeah, look, well, there's obviously a load we could talk about. These two do look now, with the lineups that they've got in front of them at this stage of the tournament, they do look like the two most potent, kind of powerful, particularly, you have Stornis Maxwell, and then you've got the Hobart boys who can do what they can do. Anyway, we're not here to talk about the BBL as much as we're looking forward to it tonight, and of course you won't miss a beat here on 11:16 SEN. You've upset a couple of people the other day, Plough. I think we knew this was going to happen. You certainly knew there was going to be a bit of blowback, and lo and behold, it's happened.
Yeah, two footy clubs in particular, for those that didn't join us on Tuesday, we basically just went through a series of four different categories for this year. We haven't had a kick in earnest yet, but the sides that I don't trust and therefore don't rate was one of the categories, and there was six clubs in that. Probably the two clubs that come the hardest in social media was certainly one of them was the Bulldogs, one of my ex-clubs. A lot of Bulldogs fans think that I've got them wrong, which is understandable. And look, in all the conversations that I had, I sort of said, look, I think around the edges, the Western Bulldogs are very, very sharp. I think they've got the best group of running, kicking defenders, I think, almost in the competition. But I just worry about their big blokes being able to stand up. You know, when you're talking about getting serious and, trying to play finals footy, I just worry about whether their big blokes, key position players and rucks, are as good as others. And so that was my take on them. But Port Adelaide have been the one that have been a little upset. I think we said right off the start, or I said, Andy, I can't lob you in with me, I said right off the start that it doesn't mean... I didn't pick just the six that I think are going to come last, because you'd be almost going with the same lot as last year if you went along those lines. But I think that a lot of Port Adelaide fans and a lot of people over in South Australia think Port are a chance of playing finals, and I just didn't see it that way for a number of reasons. But I don't think that they like the fact that I called them flaky. I didn't think that particularly went down too well. But look, I sit there in defence of that. I mean, they were in almost the perfect position last year, come about round 16 or 17, where they looked like they were going to play top four footy, and then they end up falling apart and not even making finals. And, that loss to Fremantle over there was terrible. I go back 12 months earlier, they played in a home final, where it ended up being a draw in extra time, but playing a home final against Dad's Army, against a side, the West Coast Eagles, that were so old at the time and had the game in their grasp and dropped that as well. So I just think in recent years, they were never used to be that way. I remember the mantra of Ken Hinckley, we will never give in. And that was the way that they used to play their footy, fight it right out to the end. But I haven't seen that in recent times. I think they went a little younger in picking up some nice draft selections, but I'm not sure that they're going to help them next year. And they lost a couple along the way. I mean, I understand that if you see from their point of view, they probably say, you know, we discovered a couple of players last year. We get a premiership ruckman come into our football club. We get a runner-up in the Rising Star come in. So, all of these things are either glass half empty or half full.
Oh, there are some words, aren't there, Terry, that if you label a footballer or a football team, you know, a certain way, it will rankle supporters of that club. If you and you know, flaky is one of those words that nobody in a pro league, particularly a combative sport like Aussie rules, nobody wants to be considered flaky. No one wants to be considered soft. No one wants to be seen. You know, there's other words that we can throw at footy teams. At the minute you label a team that way, you know that a few people are going to get their hackles raised, and it's up to them. I would have thought to prove the people who do label them that way incorrect. And there's only one way you can do it. You can get upset and send tweets and ring talkback numbers all you like, but at the end of the day, there's only one way and one place you can sort that stuff out.
Of course. None of us in this industry, or most of us, don't wish ill will against any side. But look, you can't have them all. You can't have 18 sides making the eight. So you've just got to call it the way that you see it. I've got some doubts around the Port Adelaide Football Club. You know, if they prove me wrong, good luck to them. I mean, that's always going to happen in this nature. And to be fair about it, I mean, the West Coast Eagles last year, I didn't see their two young boys, their two flankers doing what they ended up doing last year. They virtually, Ryan and Rioli, come from nowhere. The improvement and the rapid increase of their midfield, but even 3 weeks out from finals, I didn't see the rucks being able to knock over Max Gorn and Grundy 2 weeks in a row, and that was only with 3 weeks out. So things change a lot in this competition. And that's the nature of the competition. If I've given them a little bit of a needle, well, so be it. See how they respond.
So they're one of those teams, I reckon, and we can probably talk about them the way we're going to talk about Sydney a bit later on. They're one of those teams that will discover and refine and identify the way they want to play, as the season kind of unfolds. So that's them in total. But there's some interesting players, individuals going into 2019, Terry, that I think a lot of people and fans of teams will be keen to see their coach and coaches, in inverted commas, settle them down. Like, let's find the best way to use it. And I know you've identified a bunch of players who fit into this category, but players who maybe are so good that by dint of their versatility and ability to sort of shape the game in a number of different ways do get used in a variety of positions, and maybe at the end of the day it just detracts a little bit from their capacity to be the very best they can be.
Well, I thought there was two at the start of last year, almost from round one last year, that I sat there and was just really interested in what's going on here. How is this playing out? One was Cale Hooker. So many of us in the footy industry saw him as being an All-Australian defender and an adequate forward. They had other options that they could go to in their, in their forward line structure that potentially could have done the job. And I remember their best player in the first of the JLT games last year was McKernan. He was certainly their very best player. Yet we get to round one and he doesn't play because they were so locked in their mind about Hooker's going to be our forward and we're going to structure our side around that. Well, it wasn't until Hooker went back that things really sort of settled down and the Hooker-Hurley combination sort of got itself working. So they ended up sorting that one out. I'm presuming that that's now organised, fixed and locked away. The other one to me was Trengove at the Bulldogs. He comes to the club, and usually when a player comes to a club, you've locked down and spoken to the player as well about what this is going to be your position. We've got you here for this specific role. He came to the club. I remember I was up in Canberra in their first game against GWS. He played forward for the start, so he played all over the place in the practice match series. He started forward in that particular game, ended up playing ruck. By the first three or four rounds, he had played three or four positions. He played ruck, key forward, ended up going key defence. You just got to settle some players down. Some players handle that really well. I mean, Bob Murphy, who was on earlier on today, I think he was one who actually quite enjoyed the challenge of being thrown from a half-back flank. All of a sudden now he's a hit-up key centre-half forward. He actually liked that challenge. Some players really dislike that. You know, they want to be settled. Now, Darcy Moore is one that comes to mind straight away for Maggie fans, that they've got to sort him out as well.
Okay, 1-300-736-736. If there's a player at your club that you've been frustrated by this very situation, that he's been used in a variety of different roles, you reckon you've identified the best way to use the player, but you get frustrated slash annoyed by the coach and the coaches throwing him around the place. 1-300-736-736. Terry, there's others in the comp, and there's three that I'll ask you about. Marcus Bonapelli, Nathan Fyfe, and Paddy Dangerfield. Arguably, you could argue that they're the three best players in the competition if you wanted to. Do they have to be used the way that they've been used? Multi-faceted, versatile, or is there a different way or an alternate use for any of those three or all of those three that might see them produce week in, week out, the absolute best they can produce?
Well, I think first up, one of those is going to be a lot different than the other two because of the structure of what's come into the footy club, and that's Nat Fyfe. I mean, all of a sudden they've brought in Hogan Lobb, so they've changed the full structure.
Yep.
What I think all three coaches in this situation looked at was, okay, we've got a star midfielder, but we believe that star midfielder could potentially kick 40 goals as well and impact both midfield and forward. I think all three, with Fyfe probably being a little less than the other two, I think all three are absolutely number one rolled gold midfielders, stars. And we've heard Geelong already sort of say, look, they're going to put Dangerfield back into the middle, you know, more often than not. And I think that that's the right attitude. Those three blokes are three of our absolute very, very best midfielders in the competition. As much as what you like them to be, that and 40-goal forwards, gee, I mean, yeah, these are the guys that actually destroy teams, along with Dustin Martin, obviously, at Richmond. They destroy teams with their bulk and their size and their athleticism through the middle of the ground. So to me, I thought all three played too much time out of their rightful position. And the reality is, I mean, if you had those three, I would say at the start of last year, you would say all three would be favourites to win their club best and fairest.
Oh, that's absolutely. Yeah, no doubt.
Not one of the three. And so you might get a combination. You might sort of say, okay, well, I'm betting on two of them will win it and one, you know, might just have a, you know, miss a few games or whatever. None of the three won their club best and fairest because they were floating from dual positions, I think too much. Clearly, you can go and rotate at times, but you know the emphasis for those guys has got to be in the middle of the ground.
Right, we've got a couple of callers who want to throw some names at your plough. Cole's in Ringwood. Who have you got? Who's routinely frustrating you, Cole?
Good afternoon, boys. Clearly, from a Kangaroos point of view, I think the way this young boy came into the club and what we had to give away for him, the raps after his first year, comparisons to Luke Hodge, I don't know what's gone wrong, but Luke McDonald, for me, I don't even know the answer where he should play. I'm hoping you guys might know, but by geez, he's very, very frustrating. He's not overly big. He's not overly quick. Yes, he's competitive. He's kicking. He's poor. Geez, I hope he turns it around this year because unless for the fact that he's best mates with Josh Kelly, that's the only reason I can see why he's still on the list.
Where would you settle him down, Terry?
Yeah, well, my answer would have been I think his best position's wing. But, you know, with Pollock coming into that side, it doesn't leave much opportunity because, I mean, Pollock's going to play one wing. There's no doubt in my mind that will be the case that it plays. So he's either looking at the other wing spot or half-back, you know, and then he's up against the likes of McMillan to play that role. So, yeah, it's a challenge for him. I mean, he's certainly got it all ahead of him to really lock himself away. I'm not as harsh as the caller was on him. I've seen him His best is quite good, but he can, you know, really change from... Look, a coach driving to the game is not exactly sure still at the moment what you're going to get out of McDonald.
Thanks for your call, Cole. Tom's in Frankston. Who is it for you, Tommy?
Oh, g'day, fellas. Love the program. Look, I'm a bit concerned about James Ash at the Pies. There was definitely improvement from Chris Main, and his final series was pretty good. James Ash seemed to be not being able to be... He does cameos. I know he had that bad injury. But he kept someone like... Oh, I would have thought Crocker would have been a better bet in the finals, maybe even the grand final. There is improvement, but it's slow, and I'm just wondering, where's his best spot? He gets pushed off the ball easy. He does give it a red hot go, but I'm just wondering if that's enough.
I'm wondering the same. I think that's reasonable. The upside of him, the injury, and I was there the day that he got hurt, he helped his side, you know, sort of get the opportunity to try to win a game of football by bravery, and that's not always been the case for Ash. I mean, you could sort of, early in his career, question whether he was physical enough at the challenge, but I think he's improved that side of his game. There's no doubt about that. Great question about what's his best position. I think wing, but wing high half forward, but certainly you couldn't lock him in at the moment and sort of say he is a wingman, he is a high half forward, he is a half-back flank. And that leaves yourself very, very susceptible as a player when you can't necessarily identify, because the side gets selected, you know, in a match committee sense, Andy, and you know, you would have been a part of these sort of discussions. You start to put the team together and you put all the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle that you know and that you trust in certain positions. Well, then you end up with 10 or 12 blokes with three or four spots left. And I think that's what Ash finds himself in that position, or would find himself in that position, in nearly every discussion at match committee.
Thanks, Tommy. Johan's in Mount Wavell. He's got one for you as well. Plough, far away, Johan.
Yeah, just to it, Geelong. Once Harry Taylor, he just has to play up back. I mean, his intercept marking and his read of the play is elite, and that's his best position. And the other one left field is Tom Hawkins. He just has to play the 50-metre arc. You know, when he takes four grabs on the wing, I just throw my hands up and think, what's the point?
Welcome back to the show. Terry Wallace in the studio. So those three that we got off the text, Terry, before we went to Steph, Christian Petrarca, Tom Boyd, Jacob Wiedering. Have you got, when you close your eyes and you see them being the very best they can be for their three teams, have you got a spot for them?
Yeah, well, the text message said that Petrarca is a midfielder who's wasting his time as a forward because he's lost his... In front of goal kicking skills at the moment. I don't see him that way. I see him as a high forward who can play through the middle of the ground. So I sort of, that's more the role that I see him, and I'd like to sort of see him settle down. I don't think he's necessarily got the tank to go through the middle of the ground on a full-time basis, and that'll improve as the years march on, but I still see him at the moment. High half forward who has the dynamics to go in and impact through the middle of the ground, which has probably been Jordan DeGoey's lot as well. Tom Boyd, is he a ruck? Is he a forward? I think he's played, well, the only real good football that we've seen him play, in my personal opinion, was as a ruckman. So I see him as a ruck who rests forward rather than the other way around. I get the sense they would like eventually for him to be the other way around, that they would play English as the ruckman and have Boyd as the forward who can go in and do that extra 25% or whatever through there, which I think Tom Lynch will do the same thing at Richmond, you know, help Nankervis out in that role. So I don't have any problem. Some people are a bit worried about, gee, can you have your good power forward, you know, your star player, you know, someone like a Lynch, should they be rucking? I see it completely the opposite. Let's just use Lynch for the example. Freeze them up. I mean, all of a sudden, they're not playing against, you know, two or three extra men all the time. They get a bit of freedom to be able to go out and just, you know, run around and you know, clunk a few marks. And from a Richmond point of view, all of a sudden, it changes the dynamic of that forward structure to where it's been in the past, with Riewoldt one out in those stages with all the little blokes around him. So, you know, opposition defences are going to have to worry about the two dual key forwards playing there, all Australian key forwards playing there. And then at other times, gee, it's back to, you know, that small mosquito fleet type look with Riewoldt running it there. So yeah, I think they can balance that out beautifully.
Yeah, there's something nice about all of that. And Wiedering, is he last line or do you like him a bit higher up the ground?
I like him higher up the ground. Look, I've said before, I would love to see him play as a wingman who is almost almost the seventh defender, because I think his ball use coming out of the defensive area is excellent. I don't think he's super quick. And last line, you know, that closing speed can sometimes, you know, cause or create him a little bit of trouble. But I like ball in hand with him. I think he reads the play well. I would love him as the seventh defender, just the sweeper coming off a wing. I sense that they'll play him as the higher defender.
For robot building supplies, supply and deliver all the products you need to get the job done right.
Afternoons with Andy Marr on SEN.
Great to have you with us this Thursday afternoon. Terry Wallace back in the studio. We're over here in Hobart enjoying the show now and getting ready for the BBL semi-final thereafter. You'll hear that, of course, on 11:16 SEN later on tonight. Watch it on Channel 7 if you want to do that as well. I'll park the Sydney stuff for a moment because the coaching stuff's real interesting. You obviously coached at two and we know you had conversations, you know, with Sydney. You can name them if you like, or you can choose to take the fifth. But how many other clubs on the way through spoke to you formally, informally, officially, unofficially about a coaching role at their particular club?
I think you'll be a little surprised. And this is along the journey. So a couple of these were before I ever got a job. Others were, you know, whilst I was in either in employment or out of employment in between the two coaching jobs I had. So I had phone discussions with three clubs that never went any further than having a discussion with the club about their position, where I was at the particular time, and for, you know, certain reasons it didn't go any further than that. So those three clubs were Carlton, St Kilda and Fremantle at all different times along the journey. So those three clubs, certainly I had discussions with about coaching their football club, but it never went any further. And I had interviews with the following clubs. So these are formal interviews. Some were at my place, some were at the obviously the offices of the club, or, you know, certainly location at the club. Sometimes, you know, you'll have a corporate person, you know, they'll use their facility. So I've had interviews with Adelaide, Brisbane, Fitzroy, Geelong, Hawthorn, Sydney, and obviously the Bulldogs in Richmond.
Gee whiz.
So you don't always get the job, Andy. I mean, that's the other thing it shows.
So let's look. We know the Sydney story. We know you got the job at the Western Bulldogs and Richmond. Out of all those others, leave the informal.
I can tell you that the Sydney one, the time that everyone thinks about, I actually had spoken to Sydney previous to that as well. So I've spoken to Sydney twice in relation to their coaching positions.
And the first time, were you as... I mean, clearly you thought you were going to get the job the second time. The first time round, and I'll ask this question of the other five, Adelaide, Brisbane, Fitzroy, Geelong, Hawthorn. In your own heart, how close do you reckon you got to winning the job at any of those clubs?
I thought the process that I went through at two of them was just lip service. So therefore, the jungle drums were telling you that it was going another direction. And so that was Adelaide and Geelong, both of those clubs. It was when it was around the Neil Craig time, the Adelaide situation. And Geelong was Gary Ayres, when Gary Ayres got the position. Okay. So I thought they were lip service. Probably the two closest ones were Hawthorn and Sydney.
Does it? I mean, the Sydney story's been well told. Does it somewhere in the pit of your gut sort of stick a bit that you didn't get the chance to coach at Hawthorn?
No, because that was because I decided not to take up the position.
Okay.
I believe in my heart of hearts, if I had have decided and determined to take the position, it would have been mine.
And can you tell me why you chose not to take it?
Look, only for the fact that they were very, very late on the scene. And I think at that stage I would have had 11, 12 interviews with Richmond. And we were a long, long, long way down the track with the Tigers when Hawthorn came into play. And so it was almost a little confusing from that point of view, because I hadn't sort of factored them into my thoughts at that stage. My leaving of the Hawthorn when I left the football club, that was another factor that just, I thought that there may be some there that, weren't happy with that. And so if things turned bad at any stage, would that sort of come back to bite me? But then the major reason was I had a son who was coming through the system at the time, who I would have been in the position that Dennis Pagan found himself in at North Melbourne, where I would have had to be making the call on his career at that stage. And I just thought as a parent, that was untenable. And I don't think at that level, it's very easy to coach your own son and have a balanced sort of assessment of him versus you're either too hard on him, or others think that you're giving him a leg up. And I just didn't think that would work.
Were all those interviews that you're having, were they all for the senior coaching position, or were they?
No, every one of them was a senior coach.
Every one of them was. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So that's fascinating, Terry. And you've lived a life in footy, so it's a surprise that there were that many, to be honest. To me, it is. And maybe others won't be quite as surprised, but it's not a surprise that many clubs knocked on your door. I'm just trying to think of the timeline of that Hawthorn approach. Had you got the job at Hawthorn, would that have meant that the Clarkson era didn't arrive at Hawthorn?
Correct. Yes.
Oh, wow. Sliding doors.
It is. It's an amazing thing, isn't it? I mean, Hawthorn basically at that stage, I mean, they were looking at Ayersy, myself and Rodney Eade. I believe that I had the front running of that group, and that if I had said yes, I was asked the question, would I coach them?
Do you want the job?
Yep. Yes. So from that point of view, and then they went back to the drawing board. It actually took them quite some time after that to work through the process and work out where they were going, and to get the right man for the job. And that was absolutely Clarko at that stage. So that's the way it played out. And
you've explained your reason, perfectly. Are there any regrets?
No, never. In all honesty, I mean, you make your own way. Gee, you think about the house that you sold at a certain time, that how much it's worth now. I mean, if you sit there with your life through that, I mean, you'd never ever sort of be able to sort of sit comfortably with yourself. So look, you make your decisions. Some work, some don't work. I mean, that's the nature of life. When they don't work, you've got to dust yourself off, get up, go again, and see what you can make of the next part of your life.
So the question, I mean, that's really interesting, Player. But the reason I wanted to talk to you about this sort of today was because of the chat we had with Andy Collins, and you said you heard a bit, most of it yesterday.
Yeah.
The power of personality, the CV, your capacity to do the job, is clearly or hopefully, scrutinised to the nth degree before it gets to a position where they're going to offer somebody the job. But how big a role does that, the charisma, the power of a personality have, do you think, at clubland at this level, AFL level? How big a factor is that?
I think it's a much bigger factor than what it should be. Relationship building, that side of it should be the most important thing. But what it can get down to is it can get down to your presentation skills. And I don't think that that's necessarily the right way for it to play out, but certainly that is the way that it can play out. I've had a couple of coaches, assistant coaches that I've seen along the journey that I clearly believe were good enough to coach at senior level, but weren't necessarily the best in front of a group Yeah, and they were good in front of their group, the players, you know, like locked in a room and doing that sort of thing. But when you're talking about, you know, putting together, a PowerPoint presentation and being able to give a 90-minute spiel to corporate-type people, they weren't that wasn't their area of expertise. But that shouldn't be the reason why you're selecting a coach. But a lot of times the people, and it has changed a little bit, now where once upon a time, you know, you were presenting to boards, where now you're more likely to be presenting to a, you know, coaching subcommittee, which I think is a far smarter way to be doing it, because the board people are used to people who can present and do exactly that. So what do they look for? They look for the powerful, confident person in the room, and that's the way it used to always run. But it's certainly, as I said, it's changed back to more football-oriented people making those decisions on behalf of the club.
You know Andy Collins well. Just quickly, how highly do you rate him as a coach of footy teams?
His ability to get the best out of young men, I think, is absolutely outstanding. And how he hasn't forced his way into the AFL system more than what he has at the moment. It just absolutely amazes me that somebody hasn't gone down that pathway with him. And I had him when I was at Richmond. He was coaching Coburg at that particular time, and I thought he was outstanding. We were broke, and one of my greatest regrets, and Andy ended up having to go across to South Australia, you may recall, to do his coaching over there after a stint with Coburg. We couldn't afford. We just didn't have the money at the time at Richmond to put him on. I would have loved to have him as part of my coaching package and have him coaching his own side, which was Coburg at the time. If we had had the money, I would have had him in 2 seconds as part of my coaching group. But just we were broke at that stage, and virtually who we had was, you know, we couldn't grow or develop. And look, that was one of the problems back at Richmond at the day that, thank goodness, nowadays is not the case.
Brendan McCullum, who we did say was going to join us on the show off the top, has been good enough to take our call, and he's on a tight timeline, as he always is, a man in great demand. So we have to get to him before we get to your calls. Brendan McCullum, thanks for joining us.
Jeez, you're coming in hot on the back of the Darren Weir conversation, aren't you?
Well, you know what? It's an uncomfortable segue, but a perfect segue for someone like you. And it was a question I was going to ask you, because, you know, we know that, you know, you love your horses, and it's something you're probably going to, you know, you're invested in, and arguably going to become more invested in, you know, once the cricket's done, which it looks like it is. I'm interested to know, before we talk about your cricket, with your the ownership that you have of horses, Brendan, do you talk to trainers about treatments? Do you talk to trainers about techniques? Is that something that previously or maybe in the future you've had an interest in knowing more about?
Well, definitely, mainly because of the correlation with being a professional athlete. Well, I'm probably more of a semi-professional athlete than a professional athlete. But the understanding of how to prep your own self for a game and what's required, and also post-game as well. So, you know, I like to take a bit of an interest in that. I've got good relationships with our trainers, especially in New Zealand, and some of the horses that we're racing in Australia as well get on well with those boys. But, you know, New Zealand being a bit smaller as it is, your relationships are obviously naturally pretty close. And so always sort of keeping abreast of what the boys are up to or the girls and see how they're going about getting, well, I guess ensuring that the horse is given every chance. Obviously every horse is different, no different to every athlete's different, and they require different stuff to be able to get it to perform at their peak legally, I'd like to add.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's obviously, you know, that's where a lot of horsemanship can come into.
And, of course, it's, you know, the focus of so many of us this weekend, of course, with Winx returning to the track and the All-Star Mile, the middle of March. It's not too far away. And am I right in saying you've got a bit of an ambassadorial role with the All-Star Mile, or you've got any involvement with this, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, I'm an ambassador for it, so I'm really excited about that actually as well. To be able to, I guess, cross codes a little bit, really sink teeth into my other passion, which is horse racing, and to be a part of what promises to be a pretty good event. It's a unique event, that's for sure, from Australian racing's point of view. And the horse that I'm backing, Tom Melvin's, just sitting outside now tied the cutoff at the moment, so we're hoping to get a few more votes for him. But in general, I'm just an ambassador for the event. I'm coming over for the barrier draw, which I'm sure will be a pretty good time, and hopefully, you know, we can be a part of something which launches really successfully.
Now, when and if Tom does make the final field, Mackie, you're quite ready for him to run a gallant second or third, or just outside the big prize money. You're ready for this, aren't you?
Yeah, well, everyone needs a people's horse. When he won the other day, I was actually at the Golden Nugget Pub in Melbourne watching. I was with Chris Lynn actually, and we're watching on a Saturday afternoon, having a couple of great Northerns watching, and Tom Melbourne won. The place absolutely erupted. It was incredible. He is genuinely a people's favourite horse, and everyone knows the history. Everyone knows that he's been shy of the winning post over the last couple of years, but he was he got up the other day, and I know some of the owners too. They're great people. I can tell you, if he does make the field and he happens to run anywhere near the front at the closing stages, then the whole of New Zealand will be erupting as well.
Well, mate, who knows? The psychology of sport with human beings, and likely with animals as well. Who knows? Now that he's broken the drought, he might just go on a winning streak. The horse has clearly got talent. I mean, nobody's ever doubted the fact that the horse has got some ability, but he might just go on a bit of a tear now.
Well, it's no different to cricket. You miss out a fair few times in a row, but once you get a couple out of the middle and you feel pretty good about yourself, who knows what can be achieved. So that's the theory I'm taking in. But, you know, obviously Winx, really excited to see her back, and what a superstar of the turf, and just a truly amazing story with Jockey and Hugh and trainer and Chris as well, just the way that they can somehow get her to be able to just go out there and dominate. And she doesn't do it easy, we all know that. She is just an out-and-out champion, and it's going to be great to see her back on the turf on Saturday.
We had Paddy Webster on the show yesterday, the trainer of Happy Clapper. We're talking to Brendan McCullum, by the way, just in case you couldn't recognise the voice. And they can. So, but we had Pat Webster on the show yesterday, Brendan, and I asked him, you know, how would you feel if your horse was the horse that, you know, sort of broke the Winx streak? And he didn't even want to contemplate it. If you were, you know, the sole or principal or owner of a horse that ended the Winx streak, how would you feel?
Well, firstly, it'd be great to be in that situation, wouldn't it, if you're contemplating it? But, geez, I don't know. Mark Taylor, he declared when he was on, what, 275 or something, because he didn't want to go past the great Don Bradman. So I don't know. I don't know. But, I mean, I think she's just a superior athlete to everything else that's on the turf. So I'd struggle to see her being beat. She's going to be beat. This is probably the time. But hopefully she's able to show wares this weekend. I think if there is one horse that could give her a bit of a fright at some stage during the campaign, it could be the Autumn Sun if they do happen to line up against each other. But, hey, we'll also like to see a bit of theatre, a bit of drama. So, you know, hopefully she wins, but she has to pull on all the reserves to do so.
It looks like that's not going to happen. Hey, we're down in Hobart tonight for the semi. The Hurricanes taking on the Stars. It does promise to be a hell of a game of cricket. The weather, if it stays friendly for us, who knows what we're going to see down here tonight. It's all over for you, mate. You've decided to park it. You're going to give it away from a Heat perspective, a BBL perspective. It just felt like the time was right for you to hang it up.
Yeah, it did, mate. And I've never been one that holds on. You know, I like to be able to go out while you're still competitive, go out while people know that it's sort of been your decision. And whilst this year I've been sort of fits and starts, really. I've either kind of contributed or been pretty poor. I still felt as if I had a bit in the tank. But at the same time, you know, it's 12 months is a long way away. And I just felt that the time that I've had with the Heat has been amazing. And the people that have been there have been amazing. And to be able to get out on your own terms and know that the boys will be, you know, ready for whoever it is that comes next was just a decision that myself and my family made, and where I have absolutely no regrets about it. I've had a long time playing for the Heat, had a long time in the very top level of competition as well, and I'll continue to play these leagues around the world for the remainder of 2019, but then we'll start to transition into a little bit of maybe commentary and a little bit of coaching as well. Hopefully got some IP and some skills there that might be able to be transferred into coaching. So we'll see how we go. But, yeah, it's been good fun. Hopefully tonight, those wars, whatever, have a good game. I genuinely thought we were half a chance of getting there. But in hindsight, you know, the realistic aspect is this is probably a pretty fair reflection of where we're at this year. And those guys are in the top four. They deserve their chance, and I wish them all well.
Mate, you made a towering contribution to this league, so that will never go unrecognised, I'm certain. When the history books are written about the Big Bash League, Brendan McCullum's name will be mentioned often and with great affection. Last one before I leave. I know you've got a game of squash coming up, and we'll look forward to seeing you down here when the All-Star Mile rolls around, the barrier draw and all the other bits and pieces that go along with it. But you're going to close the door on competitive cricket playing at the end of the year. Is it obvious that one moment, unless the best moment is still yet to happen in your cricket playing career, is it obvious what your greatest moment, you know, in international cricket has been for you?
I think the most, the moment that I'll remember for the rest of my life, and it's not necessarily a performance element, it's the moment that that we found out that Phil Hughes had passed away, and the impact that had on our team and the job that I had as captain of New Zealand at the time to be able to look after the guys and try and navigate ourselves through some emotions, which even though we weren't from Australia and we weren't super tight with Phil, just the fact that one of the player playing cricket could pass away in those circumstances just made us all realise that the game could at times be life or death. And so that had pretty extreme circumstances behind it, and I guess the position I found myself in as leader of the New Zealand team at that stage and trying to find or navigate the waters for us moving forward was probably the proudest moment that I was able to deal with, because I think what we stumbled on is that we all care about one another. We're whilst it's a sport, you know, we're out there trying to have fun as well and to just cherish the relationships and the moments that you have as a team. And I think that transferred into a fairly happy-go-lucky kind of approach with our cricket, and from that point on, we always kind of took the game on and played it in the right spirits, and I think that kind of defined the era that we played, and out of travesty came a period of success for New Zealand, which will hopefully continue for a period yet. So that would probably be the moment that stands out most for me.
Oh, mate, it's a great legacy that you leave New Zealand cricket, but hopefully world cricket. It would be better for sport, not just the game that you've played for so much of your life, if that kind of approach and attitude was adopted by so many others around the world in whatever games it is that they play. I know you've got a game of squash coming up, mate. We'll let you go. Congratulations on everything you've been able to do in our domestic T20 league here. You made a gigantic contribution. Thanks for all of that. And at the end of it all, mate, enjoy owning the horses, enjoy your family, and enjoy retirement, whatever it looks like from a playing perspective. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, lads. Take care.
Great to have you with us this Thursday afternoon. In case you just join us, I'm down here in Hobart, not in the command central position with the team. Travis Cloke to join us this hour. I'm down here. Of course, we've got the BBL semi-final tonight. Looking forward to that. Two of the most dynamic, in fact, probably the two most dynamic sides in the competition playing for a spot in the final, the Hobart Hurricanes and this version of the Melbourne Stars. They are both tantalising propositions. If they get going tonight, this will be a game worth watching. Before we get to Clokey, 1300 736 736, if you've been listening to the show this week and you've been wanting to hear the audio that we've been promising that we're going to play, that being a conversation taking place between Spike Lee and Bill Simmons. Well, we are going to play it. We're going to play it in a moment, so stay tuned. We're also going to hear from Denzel Washington. And it's about sports moments in sports films. And we're going to try and drill in on the way through to the stories behind the great sporting moments in films. He Got Game was the one that got me thinking about this. So we'll hear from the director of He Got Game and the key actor in that in a moment. But we started having a chat about this the other day, and it got us thinking about the great sports films that we've loved, and we're going to bowl them up on the way through. And I'm desperate at some stage to try and get somebody who can join us on the show to tell us just how good a baseballer Robert Redford actually was in The Natural, because if you've seen it, I'd love to get your thoughts on it. There's moments when he hits the ball where he looks like a really, really natural hitter. But there's just a couple of scenes in the movie when he's got the ball in his hand and he looks a bit awkward. So we'll try and get behind. This is what we're going to try and do. And if you've got any recommendations for us, we'd love to hear from you. Scenes from sports scenes from movies that you'd like to know the story behind. The natural is the nomination today. And a bit later on, as a leaping off point for this, we're going to ask you about what you think the greatest Robert Redford movie of all time is. But I've got The Natural in the top five. We're going to come up with the top five in a moment. And if you just want to relive a little moment of what it was that made the natural so great, here's just a little scene when he comes back in the second iteration of Roy Hobbs as the player.
Did you ever play organized ball in your life?
I just got back in the game.
What does that mean?
I used to play in high school.
Excuse me?
I used to play in high school.
Reddy used to play in high school. That's nice. Scotty Carson signs him up. The judge okays the deal. Ain't talked to me yet. I got that in my deal for as long as I live. They gotta talk to me.
They got a contract.
I want to see it. Oh, come on, Hicko!
It's a great Wilfred Brimley. It's a great scene in the dugout. If you've seen the movie, you know what he's been through. If you haven't seen the movie, I don't know what you're doing. You shouldn't be listening to a radio station like ours. If you haven't seen The Natural, and if you haven't seen it, and you've got a couple of hours up your sleeve tonight, whatever you have to do to get yourself a copy of it, get a copy of it, or trawl your way through whatever TV streaming services you've got at home, you have to find The Natural and watch it tonight. So we're going to try and find out down the track just how good a baseballer Robert Redford was. But it got us, this whole seed was sown on Arvo's because we were listening to a conversation that took place between Spike Lee, the director of He Got Game, about the basketball scene, the great one-on-one basketball scene between Denzel Washington and the one and only Ray Allen. Here's a little bit of how that played out on He Got Game.
Point game. Just play the game.
Just play the game? I learned that from you. You better D up, Jake.
Point game.
This your last shot.
Come on, where you at?
Time. What you looking around for? That's game, 11-5. Jake? Somebody call a stretcher. Stick a fork in him, he's done. Take your old ass back to Attica.
It's such a great movie. I'm sure most of you have seen it. Again, if you haven't, you need to do yourself a favour and get a copy of He Got Game and have a look at it. The story behind that one-on-one basketball scene is absolutely fascinating. And Bill Simmons, who, again, a lot of you will know, great American sports broadcaster, does some fantastic podcast work over in the States. And he gets a lot of actors. He does spends a lot of time talking about movies, as much time talking about movies as he does talking about sport. And they all want to come on his show. Denzel Washington has been on the Bill Simmons podcast, and he discussed that scene with Bill Simmons.
So the He Got Game, you against Ray Allen. Mm-hmm. He's supposed to beat you. The story I've heard was he was supposed to beat you like 11-0 or whatever the final score was. And they staged the game, and you're playing it. You're ad-libbing the game, basically. You're just playing it.
Right.
And you decided to score the first 4 points, and Ray Allen didn't know that was going to happen. Is that story true or not true?
The whole time I told Ray I wasn't good with my left hand, which I wasn't.
Yeah.
All I was doing every night was practicing left hand every night, 2-3 hours. I'm like, oh man, I don't have it. I never let him see me practice.
Yeah.
So if you ever go back and see the movie again, first thing I do is start going left.
And he doesn't see that coming.
He doesn't see it coming. And I got lucky. Some shots started going in.
Yeah.
Then it got good to me. Now the New York's coming out of me. Now I'm bragging. I think I ran around.
You did.
By the
you
time
did a
I
lap.
Ran around twice, I knew I was already done. I'm like, yeah. All right, I'm good.
I could not have gone back to Mount Vernon if he beat me 11-0.
So he thought he was supposed to beat you 11-0 and had no idea.
And I let him think that he was going to beat me 11-0.
So you rope-a-doped him.
That's correct.
Fantastic. So he was a really good varsity basketball, college basketballer, apparently, Denzel Washington, which Ray Allen did not know about. And that is part of further revelation about this basketball scene that was made when Spike Lee, the director of He Got Game and himself a manic basketball fan, spoke to Bill Simmons and told us more about that backstory of that scene in He Got Game.
I had heard a He Got Game story, so I'll get your version of it. Uh-huh. That he was supposed to lose the game 10-0, yes, yes. And he rope-a-doped Ray Allen. What is your version of the story?
Well, first, I'd like to say, we're talking about Denzel. Denzel played junior varsity at Fordham.
Oh, he's proud to talk about it.
And P.J. Carissima was his coach.
Yeah.
In the scripted version, the father-son battle and the He Got Game, the way I wrote it is that Jesus Shoulder is supposed to be his father, Jake, 12-zip. Now, Ray has never, this is his first film. So Ray is like, we got to do what the script says exactly. Denzel did not tell me, but I knew that no way in the world was Denzel not going to try to score a basket. Because Denzel still considered himself a baller.
Yeah.
So we start filming, and Denzel's just throwing up some lucky shit. It's humble. It's humble. I mean, he's like crazy.
And you're just filming the whole time. You want
I'm
them to go.
Them play.
Yeah, yeah.
So after, I think like there was six something, Ray said, look, he's, instead of saying cut, he's saying, timeout! He's making a timeout sign like he's a referee. Timeout! Timeout! And the great Susan Batson, who's one of the most phenomenal acting coaches, she's screaming at him, what are you doing? What are you doing? What are you doing? Denzel's laughing. And Ray comes to me and says, Spike, the script says I'm supposed to win 12-0. And he looks at me. I'm like, I go like this. What do you want me to do? What do you want me to do? So for Denzel, it was a moral victory.
Yeah, seriously.
Because he has scored, I think, 5 or 6 baskets.
He scored 4.
4.
So he said he told Ray beforehand, he's like, yeah, never been able to go left, but then went left. Like
that's something I was not privy to.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He was trying to pull some Jedi mind trick
right,
on
so
him.
So, and Denzel's very proud of his performance in the film because he scored those backers on. He's a Hall of Famer.
I got to say, that's one of my favorite sports movie scenes ever because I know, because Denzel starts talking to him and like real life comes into the scene and Ray Allen, you can see him like being like
Ray,
getting mad.
Ray knew that this film's going to be seen. And he knew that his fellow players were getting on his ass. Like, I know he played Malcolm X, but you let that guy score.
That's got to be like the greatest, secretly the greatest achievement of Denzel's career. Put up 4 points on Ray Allen.
That's great. It goes on and it's part of the BS report. Hopefully you enjoy that sort of stuff as much as I do. The stories behind the stories. We're going to do a bit of our own digging around on the way through and see if we can uncover those sorts of stories about the great moments in sports film history. And we're happy to take your nominations of scenes. If there are some scenes you'd like to get the background to, we'd love to hear nominations for moments in films that are that for you. We'll do our very, very best to uncover the stories behind them. But I remember listening to that for the first time about a week and a half ago and just thinking that's obviously a great scene and just a fantastic story about the background to it. Robert Redford, of course, was the man who kicked it off at the top of the hour for us with his performance in The Natural. We're going to get a break out of the way in a moment. I want your nominations. We love a list. We love movies. Most of us do. We're going to, together, try and come up with the top 5 Robert Redford films. So when we get on the other side of the break, 1-300-736-736 or 0433-98-1116. If you can't get to the phone, you can only send a text. Send through the one Robert Redford movie that has to be in his top 5. I've got my 5. I've gone through it overnight and I've tidied it up this morning. I've got my 5 that I reckon have to be Robert Redford's top 5. There's a couple on the edge that I felt very, very guilty about leaving out, not comfortable about any of them. So somebody out there might be able to convince me that 1 or 2 need to be in. And a little caveat here, I haven't seen his latest movie, Old Man and the Gun, and I haven't seen the other one that was highly rated, All Is Lost. So I'm happy to take your calls on the greatest Robert Redford movie as an actor of all time. Tommy's in Frankston. Before we get to the break and start taking calls on the greatest Redford moments in film, his greatest five movies. Tommy, fire away, mate.
Oh, g'day, fellas. Oh, Andy, look, he's one of the greatest actors of all time. He's never in a bad film.
That's true.
Look, I'll give you five. Which gets Sundance Kid.
Yes.
The Way We Were with Streisand. Follows it up with a sting with Red, again with Paul Newman. In 74, he makes The Great Gatsby. 75, one of my, I think, is fantastic film is 3 Days of the Condor. 76, he does All the President's Men.
Yes.
1980, The Natural. He's never been to Australia. And Paul Newman, who tragically died sort of in 2010, they were talking about making a film together, their last one, and incorporating in Australia, but it never happened. Apparently, he wants to tour here because he's finished acting, but he is brilliant. With Hoffman in All the President's Men, that is gripping. Gripping film.
A few that you mentioned are in the top five. What's remarkable, if you love your movies, and I think a lot of us do, Tom, the American cinema, the movies that were being churned out by America in that kind of late 60s through to about 1980, 81, 82, I reckon it was as good an era for movie making anywhere on the planet, but particularly in the United States. And Redford, as you so rightly point out, he was in, year out, he was in movies that were, you know, there's another one in the middle of them all called Brubaker. There was one right at the start called Jeremiah Johnson. He was in so many great movies in that era, Tom. We haven't all seen all of them, obviously, but I'm lucky enough to have seen a lot of them. He was just a powerhouse through that period.
And also, Andy, a lot of people, as a producer and director, he did a quiz show and he did Ordinary People with Mary Tyler Moore and Donald Sutherland. Absolutely stunning films.
Yeah,
he's world class. And I don't think we'll see his kind again. No, I'd love him to come to Australia if we could. An absolute living legend. You don't know where to look for great films with him. He can carry off any role. His screen presence amazing. But actually, did you know that James Grady, who wrote the book 6 Days of the Condor, was only 22 when Redford bought the rights and turned it into condensed the book into 3 Days of the Condor? The guy became a millionaire out of that book, James Grady. He never reached the heights again. He wrote it when he was 21. How's that?
Clearly, the movie would have gone too long had it been 6 Days of the Condor. It can only afford to be three. We would have been sitting there for too long. Hey, Tom, you've kicked it off magnificently. Appreciate your contribution. 1-300-736-736. Find out where the money's going at PointsBet. We'll clear a break. If you want to put a nomination in for Robert Redford's greatest ever movie, we're going to put the top five together before we're done today.
For Robot Building Supplies. Supply and deliver all the products you need to get the job done right.
Afternoons with Andy Marr on SEN.
SMS is flooding through with nominations about the best Robert Redford movie of all time. We'll get to you, Brendan, and Peter in a moment. Somebody wanting to know, who is Robert Redford? I'm sure if we were talking about Peter Bedford's best game of footy, we might have a suggestion from that particular SMSer. How can you not know who Robert Redford is? That's an absolute disgrace. Brendan's in Piercedale. Brendan, I've got my top five. I'll reveal it after the news headlines. But have you got one that absolutely has to be included?
Yeah, it's got to be The Natural, number one.
It's definitely in the five. I don't think it can be number one, but it's a great movie. Is there a scene in particular, Brendan, that sticks out for you from the movie?
Probably when he hits the ball into the office and smashes all the lights.
Oh, that's a great scene. He hits it into the judges. Oh, yeah, no, hits it into that dirty judges. Oh, that's a great scene. It's a great movie, Brendan. I'm going to have to go back and watch it from go to woe again. Thanks for the nomination, mate. Pete's in Coburg. A Robert Redford movie that just has to be in the top five, Peter.
Yes, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Yeah, I don't think there's much doubt about that. When was the last time you watched it?
Oh, well, it's a long time ago because I'm 64 now.
You know, when you embark on a quest like this, what do you generally do? What I do is go back to YouTube and IMDb and a couple of those sites, and you just relive moments from the movies, a little 30-second here and 2 minutes there, and it takes you back. And, Pete, there are so many Robert Redford, as Tom mentioned before we got to the break, there are so many Robert Redford movies that deserve and demand rewatching, particularly that era from about 1967, 68 through to about 81, 82. And he's obviously been involved in a couple recently that are pretty good as well, judging from those who have seen them. Appreciate your nomination, Pete. We'll reveal where that one sits in the top five in a moment. Paul's in Eltham. What's got to be in the top five, Paul?
All the President's Men. Now, the other ones are there, I understand. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and all of that. But that movie, All the President's Men, was history. It changed history of American politics and everything. And anything gate we ever say was all about what that movie was about. And he was brilliant in that. Brilliant.
I could. Hey, Paul, that scene when he's down in the car park and he's meeting his deep throat, and he says, I need to know what you know. And he said, and that's when Deep Throat says, just follow the money. You know, you're so close. And then they think they're being watched. That is one of the tension in that scene is, I'm getting goosebumps now remembering how I first felt when I saw it. It was incredible. George has suggested Brubaker needs to be in the mix. There's been a lot of love for The Natural. Spy Game's got a bit of love. The Last Castle as well has got a bit of love from the SMS traffic. But here's our top five, and you can argue with us if you like. Coming in at number five, a movie that nobody mentioned, unfortunately, Jeremiah Johnson. It was absolutely fantastic. Man decides to turn his back on our society, goes and lives in the wilderness, back in the turn of the last century, has to deal with weather and Native Americans and all sorts of stuff. It's a great movie, a tour de force from Robert Redford coming in at number five. Coming in at number four, The Natural. I would have liked to have put it higher, but the top three are very hard to dislodge from the top three. Coming in at number three was The Sting. Coming in at number two, just one of the great films of all time. And a pivotal moment in American political history told. A great book, but an equally fantastic movie. He and Dustin Hoffman, outstanding in the lead roles of All the President's Men. Coming in at number one, before we declare it, here's just a little snippet of the moment where one of the great little secrets that was kept us waiting was revealed.
If the water's deep enough, we don't get squished to death. He'll never follow us.
How do you know?
Would you make a jump like that and you didn't have to?
I have to, and I'm not gonna.
Well, we got to, otherwise we're dead. They're just gonna have to go back down the same way they come. Come on.
Just one clear shot, that's all I want.
Come on. We got to.
Nope. Get away from me.
Why?
I want to fight them.
They'll kill us.
Maybe.
You want to die?
Do you?
All right. I'll jump first.
Nope.
Then you jump first.
No, I said.
What's the matter with you?
I can't swim.
Why, are you crazy? The fall will probably kill you.
That's a great scene. A great scene, a great movie. The greatest Robert Redford movie ever made, according to us together here on 1116 SEN Afternoons, is Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And we're getting some text messages through. I didn't even know that Robert Redford died. He hasn't died. Robert Redford's still alive. We're just celebrating his body of work, and it's something we're going to do from time to time. And it's great. The contribution from you lot out there has been terrific. We'll pick another actor next week. Thanks for all your contributions as we sifted our way through the body of work of Robert Redford. I wonder whether our next guest, Travis Close, got a favourite actor he wants to nominate that we can put together the top five of next week. He's about to join us. The AGM was held last night at the Collingwood Footy Club, and amongst a couple of others, Brent McCaffer, of course, fantastic footballer, great club man for the Collingwood Footy Club. He became a life member, as did Paul Leeds, former director of the club, and longtime head physio Dave Francis at the Footy Club. Travis Cloke rightfully became a life member of the mighty Collingwood, and he's been good enough to join us the day after. Travis, congratulations, mate. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much, mate. Lovely to hear from you.
It's been a long time. We used to pester you on a weekly basis. And nowadays you live your life in relative anonymity and peace and quiet. Do you miss the cut and thrust of it all?
bits and pieces I miss of the football environment. I don't miss the day-to-day grind of the media scrutiny, that's for sure. But I miss the feeling of a footy club. There's nothing in the world that you can do that I've found that can bring that feeling of what goes on at a football club. It's one of the best feelings you'll ever have. But saying that, I lived it. I did it for 14 years, and I'm thoroughly enjoying the other side of the coin at the moment.
So did you, we hear so many stories, Trav, of players who have spent a life in the game and maybe not necessarily the lifetime that you've spent in it, literally given the family connection of the game. You've spent, more time than most in footy. We hear so many find it really hard when they exit the game. Did you have to kind of grapple any of that sort of stuff, or did retirement come relatively peacefully for you?
Oh, a bit of both. It was probably something that I'd probably tossed up to the back end of my last 6 months at the Dogs. And I was probably going through a few things there of myself and figuring my own way about footy. And that's probably the reason why I left Collingwood in the first place, just trying to reinvent myself, re-find that love for football. And once I decided to pull the pin on footy, I was lucky enough my wife gave birth 3 days later. So there was no lag time for me to sit back and enjoy. It was all hands on deck, looking after a young daughter at the time.
And how old is she now?
Just ticked over 15 months, and she's a handful, running around, having a laugh, giggle. Life's never been more enjoyable since having her a part of it.
Of course. So tell us about that. That's really interesting, to kind of reinvent, find the love, reignite what it was that, drew you to the game, before you started playing at the elite level. When you're in the game, and you're in the bubble, and there is the focus, and everybody's, casting an opinion about you. How hard is it to find your way through that?
I think I lost my identity. I was a part of this football world from a very young age. I did work experience as a 14, 15-year-old kid at Collingwood, and then got drafted as a 17-year-old, and I was still in year 11 at the time. And I'd never been outside in this real world of life, and probably the 10, 12 years of scrutiny of media, personnels, the supporters on my back, and probably my own way as well, my own game. My game was up and down there for a little bit. Obviously, my goal kicking was a topic of conversation that never went away. And I probably tried to be someone that people wanted me to be. They thought I was this number two, big 105-kilo centre-half forward for the Collingwood Football Club all the time. That wasn't me. And I guess that's where I really battled with. I'm a down-to-earth, pretty loving type of guy. I'm more of a person who's going to hug you than actually hit you. So it was tough to fight those two battles, but I'm really enjoying the other side now.
It's fascinating to hear you say that, Trav, because you're built like you've got this massive hulking frame, and yet one of the things that people may not have known about you was you had this unbelievable endurance and great running capacity for a player of your size. And I know a lot of good footy judges always were of the view that you were at your best when you were burning off opposition, blowing up opposition players, and were constantly on the move. And yet it seemed that there was this desire from so many to see you just standing in the middle of these 5 and 6 man packs and taking these clunking marks. Did you feel that you were better when you're at your best at one thing more than another?
Oh, definitely. There was probably that stage where the game style of Collingwood was that kick down the line kind of pack mark, and that was probably under Mick. And then the transition of when Bucks took over with Mick, a bit of lag, and then obviously Bucks brought in his own game style. So I brought a lot more of my running ability into that. And then the rest is history, I guess. The game's changed a lot since I started, and I guess since I finished 18 months ago. And I'm enjoying seeing the transition of where it was. I definitely think physically my body could have kept up and kept playing with football, but mentally I was just done. I couldn't comprehend the pressures of AFL football and AFL life anymore. And it got the best of me. I thoroughly enjoyed the journey of AFL football. I've turned the page on that part of my life, and I guess that was what last night was. It was an opportunity for me to say thank you to the Collingwood Football Club and the supporters. I never got to do that when I left there in 2016. It was kind of transitioned straight onto the Dogs. And it was a touching moment to receive the award off Ed and the football club and the board, and to share it also with Brett McCaffrey, my old teammate To have Bucks as a past coach, a past captain and player in the room, and then the likes of Paul Lecouriers on the board and Eddie, who's been there the whole journey from when I started as a 15-year-old kid and where I sat down and had a chat with him, and the rest is history. So I'm very blessed. I'm very happy, and I'm just looking forward to enjoying the Collingwood Football Club as a supporter.
246 games you played for them, 441 goals. Of course, the crowning moment. You had some great individual triumphs on the way through, goal kicking and Copeland's, and you know, other awards that you picked up, all Australian nominations. But 2010, clearly the crowning moment. What's it like, Trav, when you go back there? We're talking to Travis Cloak. What's it like when you go back on a night like that and you say that you want to say thank you to them, but you get a sense for how appreciative at the end of the day they are for what you've done for them and for that football club? What does that mean to a player in your position?
It's strange. I haven't even watched the 2010 grand final, and what are we nearly 9 years on?
Ever.
So I haven't watched it at all. I haven't flicked it on. People know me.
Wow.
I don't watch a lot of footy. I obviously know what happened in both games, the draw and the win, and I could tell you the bits and pieces, but I totally forgot that I kicked the goal to draw the game in the first one. People have obviously reminded me a little bit like that. Yeah. But it was humbling to go back into a room full of Collingwood supporters. And at an AGM, they're not just your normal support. These are supporters that are passionate of your football club. They're there for the interest of the club as well. And to be in front of them and to hear their stories as well, which I did for probably the first half hour of the night, just talking and socialising with the supporters. And to have my wife and daughter there, and for the supporters to meet them and also my daughter, was just as special for me as what the last 13, 14 years of playing football was. That half hour for them to have another part of me and understand what I actually am away from a football club was just as satisfying.
And does it rekindle, I'm not suggesting for one second that the love for the Collingwood Footy Club was lost at all, but does it rekindle the affection? Does it strengthen the connection? Does it make you now realise, okay, I don't need to go to the footy every single week, but whenever I want to go to the footy, I know that I can comfortably go back to, you know, that footy club with those people, and I'm going to be, you know, I'm going to be welcomed, and it's going to be a happy experience. Do you walk away from a night with that feeling intact?
Oh, definitely. When I left the club, people thought I left on bad terms with Nathan, Eddie, and the footy club, and it couldn't be any further from the truth. I sat down with those boys mid-year and explained to them where I was at and what I was going through and how I kind of wanted to pursue my footy career from there, and they were really open about it, and obviously let me go to where I wanted to do at the Western Bulldogs. And the day that I pulled the pin, I heard from both those men wishing me all the best, and the connection that we had during that 12 months I was at the Dogs was still just as constant as what I was when I was at the Collingwood Football Club. So it was reassuring that. But I went to the final series last year, watched the boys participate in them. I missed the grand final. I was on a plane to Italy on a family holiday, but I was riding every kick, every bump for that finals campaign with them as if I was a part of that group, as a playing group. I got a lot of close friends at that football club, and that'll never change. And I know that Collingwood is loved or hated by a lot of supporters, and I understand my career is probably in the exact same boat as most, but it's a club that really does have an underlying feeling of love and community. And to hear Nathan speak the way he does about this playing group is spectacular, because that guy's got a heart of love, and he just wants to love his players so much. And to see the way he's evolved, even with his connection. He mentioned last night that he wasn't a hugger. He is now. And don't get me wrong, I love that side of him, because yes. I definitely used to go into his office a little bit and show a bit of emotion. And sometimes he'd look at you a bit blank because he wasn't too sure what to do. But I know where he sits, and he's got a heart of gold.
Mate, you're a great Collingwood man, and you thoroughly deserve the gong amongst so many that you've accumulated over your career. Well done. Hopefully you bask in it for a long time and enjoy the reflected glare that comes back your way, mate. Thanks for joining us on the show. Look forward to catching up with you. Thanks for your time.
Pleasure. Thank you very much. Have a good afternoon.
Good on you. Travis Cloak, life member of the Collingwood Footy Club.